Hello, together. Duncan. How are you?
What's Prince in Wheels?
Season 1, episode 7. This Prince William name seems to have stuck. I'm not entirely sure I'm on board with it fully, but whatever. It's not my choice, not my decision.
Never going to get over it now, I'm afraid. Prince of Wheels.
A great name. I try to segue into our segments. You see, I'm trying to learn how to become a presenter. So I thought, you know, things that are beyond my control, such as the Car of the Year awards. The results are in.
The results are in.
Are we going to get straight into this,
Prince William?
A travesty has been wrought upon the South African motoring space in the fact that the Alfa Romeo Junior did not win. It is a travesty. No. What were those jurors thinking? Were they drunk? I don't understand this. It's just I'm lost for words over the outrage that is this monumental thing. It did win best design.
Car of the year. Car of the year? Why does everyone take Car of the Year so seriously in this country?
Because it's been going since Pa fell off the bus, and what it is basically a competition amongst new cars that have been released during the course of the year. So it has to be something that's been released in the calendar for the time frame of the awards, and they have a couple of different categories in that. And you'd really think that, you know, such a small market of ours wouldn't have all that much competition. But then you see the number of new cars that are being released. We've got a huge number of cars that they have to go through actual several rounds now of voting in Coty. So you can eliminate all the real rubbish to begin with, and then you just elevate the cream of the crop to the final selection process in the rounds. And as we have it, we have a family car, we have a mid-adventure. Then we have adventure. I don't know who comes up with these names. Premium, performance, people's choice, best design. And so of all those categories, and then, of course, you have an overall winner. So of all those categories, you have a winner. So the family car, for example, this year was won by the Imoda C7 Chinese.
That's a nice vehicle. That's
Mid-Adventure.
A very nice vehicle.
Yeah. Mid-Adventure was won by the Jetour T2. Also, I've seen a lot of these on the roads. They look very good. Look like mini Land Rovers, actually. Also, Chinese vehicle. Then in the adventure class, the Land Rover Defender Octa 1. Well, I don't think there's any complaints about that. I mean, the thing is just nuts. Stupid power, stupid capability, just ludicrous. Ridiculously expensive, but we'll get to price justifications in a bit. In the premium segment, the new Audi A5 one, which is, I think, okay. I'm not too sure how it's going to perform against the new BMW electric 3 Series when that comes out next year. I think that's going to be the premium choice in my particular little realm of influence. Under performance is an interesting one. It was the Audi RS Q8. That's not a small car. But, you know, I'm sure the jurors know what they're doing when they gave an Q8 a performance win. There you go. And the people's choice, interesting enough, was the Chery Tiggo 7 PHEV, plug-in hybrid EV.
Maybe a heavy car, awesome. William, but I've just looked up its 0 to 100 speed, 3.6 seconds.
So, I mean, you can't argue with performance, but, I mean, performance in straight line speed is one thing when you're lugging around 3 tons or 2.5 tons or whatever that thing weighs. Now, 2.5 seconds or 2.6 seconds or whatever it is, I'd much rather have in a two-seater sports car, but that's just me. You know, what do I know? I mean, I can imagine the power that thing generates. It's just nuts.
Pretty remarkable that you can get that thing up to 100 that quickly in a vehicle that's big and heavy. And I see the top speed on a certain spec version of it is up to 305 kilometers an hour.
I pity whatever it is you hit for that speed. Momentum is your friend, as we've always learned in sort of car crashes. I mean, if you hit anything else in that speed, it's just going away. You know, it's nuts. And then the overall winner was the Jetour T2. So that was that. So
controversially, I looked up the specs of this.
Well, controversially, according to me, it probably wasn't controversial to anybody in the jury. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we're going to generate some controversy. Damn it. Alpha was robbed.
I was surprised to see the fuel consumption of the Jetour T2. It's sitting at over 11 liters per 100 kilometers. That is not a fuel efficient vehicle. in a market where the price of petrol, what is the petrol price these days? I drive a diesel.
No, God,
diesel,
I don't know. So, I was looking.
But it's around 30 grand a litre. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. Cheaper than I thought. Look, I mean, it is a fairly substantial vehicle. It's not a small entry level little Jimny type competitor. It's considerably bigger than that. But yeah, I would have expected slightly better fuel consumption. I mean, my Disco 4 gave me better than that on the open road. But you know, it is what it is. And I think, you know, it's interesting how many Chinese cars entered this year and how well they've placed. I mean, they've taken 1, 2, 3, 4 out of the 8 categories. So
interesting,
you know,
to see the People's Choice Award going to a PHEV though. That's
it's
an interesting choice.
Well, we're seeing the interest in new energy vehicles starting to explode, and that's what we do here at Watts and Wheels. We talk about that sort of stuff. So it's good that this is starting to make a trend amongst our new car buyers. And certainly I think what's not going to be making a trend amongst our new car buyers is our next item, the new Ferrari. Ferrari have done something quite different here, because at least with Jag, what Jag did was they said, hey, everybody, we're reinventing ourselves. Here's a new car. And everyone was like, oh, boo, it's terrible. We hate it. But that was just the concept. And Jag have at least spent a year and a half for people to get used to it. I mean, I play open cars. I was a big fan of the Type 00. I thought it's an absolutely amazing looking car, exactly what Jaguar needed to do at the time. And they've given us a year and a half to get used to the idea. And then the name of it has now been firmed up as Type 01. And it looks remarkably similar to the concept, which is great. And Ferrari have just dumped this on us kind of a bit out of the blue. And there it is. And it is, well,
what's
the word I'm looking for? It's I don't think it's a Ferrari.
It's certainly not.
It doesn't look like a Ferrari. Mm. And if that's the point, and you want to make your EV strategy such that it stands so far apart from what everybody calls your DNA, by all means. But you're not Jaguar. You're not going bankrupt. You have a model lineup. You don't need to reinvent yourself. Why on God's green earth would you come up with something like this?
The reaction has been very, very interesting to watch. And the memes, I've been enjoying the memes more than looking at pictures of the car itself. I mean,
I just snorted. That's so funny. Oh, no. That's why.
No, and this is just a small sampling of thousands and thousands and thousands of GIFs.
I can imagine the internet has broken on this. It must just be trending. Well, I must say, on all, this is my favorite.
Mine too.
Enzo Ferrari spinning in his grave, generating the power to power this thing. It's been across multiple feeds on my various social medias, I must be honest. And it's one of those things where I don't know what to say. You know, it's a Ferrari. I'm never going to afford one. I don't want to buy a Ferrari. I'm really not interested. But the fact that they've made such a radical departure is quite a statement. And maybe it's just too early to judge them. It might pan out to be the best thing they've ever done.
I doubt that. So, but what interests me is that this was co-designed by Sir Jony Ive, who was the same guy who, I think, designed the iPhone, certainly the Apple Watch, and a number of other Apple products, but best known for working at Apple alongside Steve Jobs. And we know that Apple was building a car for many years, invested billions of dollars into it before eventually scrapping it. I have an idea that a lot of the design concepts for that vehicle have ended up in this car, especially with Jony Ive's involvement. And this actually is what I would have imagined the Apple car would look like, perhaps with a little less luxury in it, But I'd imagine a lot like this. And if you look at the dashboard of this, and we'll throw an image up on screen. If you look at the dash of this vehicle and the rounded square instrument panels, it looks like something Apple would design. I think we're getting a little look at the Apple car here.
You've nailed something very important here. And I think that when those first iPhones and things sort of came out, the outside of the thing was okay. But it was the functionality in the inside of the thing that was really revolutionary. And that's why I say maybe we're a little bit too early on the Luce, because the interior might be mind-blowing. It might just reshape the way cars are built, or something has happened inside there that's so stratospherically amazing that it will sell despite what it looks like. And it may be that what we've got is inspired interior design and expired exterior failure, and whether people are able to get around the fact that what it looks like on the outside belies the sheer joy of living it on the inside. If you look at the door handles, for example, those look remarkable. How they work, who knows? But there they are, and that's certainly already an indication that there's a lot of thought or something that's gone, a lot of differentiation has gone into this design. So I think that this car finds itself in the difficult position of trying to sell itself from the inside out. And that's going to be, I think, its only saving grace.
Yeah. The problem for me with this vehicle is it looks like something that BMW or even Toyota might have come up with.
Yeah.
If you slapped a BMW badge on the front of that thing and cut the price by 90%, then that would be a huge success.
No,
everyone would be raving
would
about
think
it.
Twice. Yeah. You're probably right. It's interesting. Anyway, moving on. How to make a car? How to make a car Ferrari style? Let's continue that theme. See, our segues are getting really good in this. We touched on how to do CKD versus SKD in the last episodes. So just for a refresher, SKD is semi-knockdown, CKD completely knockdown. Semi-knockdown means you can import a whole bunch of pre-assembled parts, effectively the car altogether, plug on a steering wheel when it reaches the side, and it qualifies as being built under the SKD model. See, I even get confused locally. So a lot less local content engaged in building the car, where CKD, you've got to make all the bits, including the steering wheel, and put it together in the country. So semi-knockdown, completely knockdown. Okay, so where we start to see the big difference, because we touched on where's the crossover between SKD and CKD. In other words, at what point do you decide that you're becoming a CKD model versus an SKD model? In other words, how much local stuff do you need in your car to qualify as a complete knockdown derivative? Because complete knockdown derivative is where all the jobs and things are created. So we just took a quick look into that. And in essence, our car industry employs, I don't know, 125,000 people plus another X number of thousand people that are in the car part ecosystem. So all the bits that we do make locally, generally, if you're making a steering wheel, for example, for Toyota aren't making that. They're employing somebody else to make it on their behalf to go into the car, because Toyota don't have the capacity to build out 2,000 different component manufacturers. It's just nuts. So they buy all the stuff into their spec, and it gets assembled in the car. So what happens is you end up with this value content that's created locally inside each car. And when you get to sort of 30, 40% local value content, that's when you can say your car is CKD'd. So if you take it to the extreme, you could have your 100,000 Rand car arrive, plug your 5,000 Rand steering wheel into it to generate a 105,000 Rand car under the SKD model, and you've got 5,000 Rand worth of local content from your local steering wheel. If you paid your guy 100,000 Rand to put that local steering wheel into that CKD car, then you could have 50% local content, because you've paid the guy 100,000 Rand on your 100,000 Rand car. So there's that way of doing it, okay? So there's, you can just say those are where your costs go into the local thing. That clearly is insane. You wouldn't do that, but just taken to the extreme. But when South Africa starts to deindustrialize, and we have been deindustrializing for a long time, it's because the cost of those components becomes so expensive to source locally that we source them from overseas. And the more we source things from overseas, the less our local value content becomes. For example, our steel industry, right? So smelters make steel. Steel's rolled into sheets. It's then sent to the stamping plants and turned into car parts, right? When we don't have smelters and when we don't have steel made, yeah, the steel has to come from overseas. So all the value of the raw material of the steel is now shipped out of your local content value. And the only local content value you have is the value add by stamping the steel now into the shape of the part. So you're paying the guy for the machine and the machine itself, but it's a fraction of what it was before. So it's not good or bad, but it has consequences. So that's an economic influence that happens in our manufacturing process. And as we start to deindustrialize, and as we start to bring in more and more stuff that we can't make ourselves, our local value content starts to rely more and more on the stuff that we can put into the cars: labor, tech, and scale. So the more you scale these things, the lower your cost of production can become, and you can increase your total content into it. So it's these questions that are starting, as I say, to become uncomfortable, because what's actually happening is that our local manufacturers, our OEMs, are no longer producing cars that we actually want in South Africa. We sell 64% of our cars are under 400,000 rand. Now, our local guys are not making cars under 400,000 rand, with one exception, the Vivo, that's 15 years old on a platform that's been, you know, sort of used to its maximum effect. And so the net result is the number of cars that we produce that are sold into our local market is steadily declining all the time. Toyota, I think, cited going from 61% down to 34% of their total production is now sold into the local market. So this is starting to say, well, if they're not selling into the local market, they're exporting more. And if they're not selling into the local market, into the mass in market where we have everything under 400,000, 64% of total sales, then why are we subsidizing these guys? You know, what is the point? Because if we're just creating an industry to export cars, well, the export of cars is not affected by our subsidies. So they sell the car for the price of whatever they sell it at overseas. And we're just paying to have our overseas guys enjoy pricing whilst they're eating our lunch. So it's a case of understanding that as our local content of cars produced reduces, and as the local number of cars being sold reduces, the concept of having tariffs in place becomes less and less justifiable. So it's starting to become to the point where I think we're going to start to see some changes happening, and either our manufacturers are going to start competing on much more expensive cars, or they're going to have to start thinking about how do they produce cars sub 400,000 rand that we currently import en masse from India and Malaysia and China, and start to compete with those on an even footing. And that's a really different and difficult conversation to have, I think. And on that topic, you know, it's very interesting to see what's happening, because India, you know, part of the BRICS collaboration, you know, BRICS, our good friends, have signed a trade deal with Europe where now they can get cars into Europe at far, far lower duties. So the same cars that we're buying in from India, you know, the sub 400,000 rand cars, are now going to be going to into Europe at a far cheaper rate, which is fine because we don't make those cars, but India do. And they also make the same cars that we make here. And so I think there's a matter of time before India starts competing with South Africa on the cars we do export into Europe at the moment.
That's
bearing in mind that we also still need to get into the mindset of producing battery electric vehicles for European emissions controls, which start 2030 and in the UK 2035, with a bit of leeway give or take. But we're halfway through 2026. That clock is ticking very, very, very quickly.
And it's not just India, of course. The Morocco is positioning itself for exactly that same market as well, and is well ahead of us in building the manufacturing facilities for making new energy vehicles.
Correct. So, funnily enough, what's happening here is the one to watch. I think is Chery. So they're the canary in our gold mine, and what they do with the old Nissan factory is going to be, I think, I don't want to say pivotal, but it's going to be really important in terms of how our future of auto manufacturing in South Africa unfolds, and whether we end up reducing from CKD to SKD is the logical route. You slowly start to reduce down your local dependencies. But against that background is going to be this uncomfortable question of tariffs. It's going to be there. It's not going away. It's getting bigger. It's getting noisier. And it's getting louder. We're going to have to deal with it one way or another. Policy.
We're in this position largely because the government has been so slow to actually come and formulate a proper policy position on a range of issues affecting this industry. And unfortunately, we may have left it too late.
Well, that's my stand. My little birds tell me that the can has been kicked so far down the road that it's gone over the cliff. You know, it's the Wile E. Coyote cartoon thing. But they say that happily there's a tree sticking out. You know, so you might just land on the tree and bounce back up. So the APDP2 program has been accelerated, and there are talks coming through. So we can expect some announcements coming soon. Go ahead and hold your breath. But let's see. But the way I see it, pressure is building, and something's got to give one way or another. We're either going to go forward or we're going to go backwards. We can no longer just sit in the middle and hope. Things have got to happen now.
All right, you have thoroughly depressed me now. Let's move on to something.
I'm sorry. Let me bring up something even more depressing. Okay, small cars, little city cars. We love little city cars. You know, I remember the original Fiat 500s and you know, the little minis and things. Actually, I own a little mini, and they were great fun. And here is a picture of what is known as a Mika Mino. MINO. I think that's how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And it is scheduled to be the cheapest EV running around in cities. And the cheapest EV at the moment is the Dacia Spring. So this thing has to come in under 15,000 euros, which is not exactly cheap, but I'm not sold on the looks of it, I must be honest.
No. So
it looks a bit
looks like
you know, if you're going to go. If you're going micro mobility, I think I'd rather actually just go buy a Fiat 500 from 1957 and drive around in that. to be honest, petrol engine and all.
You've seen those grotesque images that macro photography of insects close up, like ants, and they've got their eyes bulging out there. That's what that car looks like.
it's one of those things that, you know, I have a saying, you know, when some friends of mine come around with these really ugly old classic cars that they've built, something like a Lotus Elan, I'm probably going to get shot now, but the Lotus Elan was never a pretty car. I said to him, you know, it's dreadful. Get in the car, drive it to the crusher, and be done with it. And if anyone's seen you in it, you stay in the car for the crusher. It'll only hurt for a little while, but the pain is less than you being seen driving in that car. But, you know, this is one that I think it's so small and terrible that, frankly, I think it's just going to end up as pothole filler in Joburg, which is a good end to it. But
do we know anything about it? What is ranges and
300Ks. 300Ks.
Range, okay.
With two battery options, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And they're trying to get it under 500 kilograms. So that kind of range, under 500 kilograms, I don't know how they're going to do it. I think everything must be made out of plastic except the battery. But the concept is not new. You know, urban micromobility is not new. The execution of it is. But It's one of the things that actually came up with a chat I had with Mike Whitfield, who's the CEO of Stellantis in South Africa. He talks about micromobility, and we did an audio interview with him. And for full disclosure, it was before Car of the Year was announced. So we were upbeat and quite comfortable with the fact that Alpha was going to win. but this is our chat into where Stellantis see themselves, how they're going forward, and what they've got planned for the South African market, including micromobility.
All right, let's roll the tape.
Hello, everybody. It's Will from Watts and Wheels here. And today, in our ongoing interview series, I have none other than Mr. Mike Whitfield, CEO of Stellantis.
Great, and good afternoon, and thanks for inviting me to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you, Mike. And we're here to chat, as we have been a little bit outside, about where Stellantis is going in this great, big, wacky, wild world of electrification and mobility. And we've had a brief discussion around it. And I think maybe we should just kick off with, what is Stellantis' global sort of EV strategy going forward?
So I think first and foremost, Stellantis has moved away from, let's say, a traditional car company. We're a mobility company. And for us, mobility starts from micromobility all the way through. EV is critical to it, but as we announced in our plan for what we call Fast Lane 2030 last week, is that it's not electric at all costs. Electric vehicles is very much part of our core, or electric technology is very much part of our core. But for us, it's rather saying we will cover from battery to hybrid, plug-in hybrid, mild hybrid, and obviously ICE. And instead of trying to say the whole world's going this way, it's really regionalizing, adapting to what markets needs and what customers' needs are when they're ready. So very much electric is definitely a very big part of it, but it's not EV at all costs.
Gotcha. So in other words, tailoring to what it is the customer actually wants.
And the timing and what grid infrastructure's in place.
100%.
And you have different – we live on the Africa continent, and I think there's certain countries in Africa where probably plug-in hybrids are far more appropriate than full battery electric at this stage. But there will be a transition. It's a journey.
Well, I think this is exactly what the industry is finding out. You know, it's a case of understanding who your market is, what it is they want, and matching your products to them accordingly.
I think if you go back and you just look at how fast technology is going, and you'll realize you go back to the first mass production electric vehicle introduced into the world was the Leaf, the Nissan Leaf, where your battery costs were probably in excess of 150 kilowatt an hour or whatever dollars.
Yep.
Nowadays it's below 50.
Correct.
And it's going even further.
Well, we were chatting about how rapidly the technology is changing, and how the advent of the Chinese have had a massive influence on the global vehicle market at a pace that was totally unprecedented. And I think Stellantis is boxing clever by partnering with the right people. And you were talking about how business is changing and how it's evolving to one of partnering with people as opposed to trying to do everything yourself.
Very much so. And I think for those who had seen or listened to what we shared globally last week in our fast lane, that is that for us, partnerships are critical. Mm. So, yes, we've had a partnership for a number of years with Leap Motors, where we're an equity partner. We also are a major partner in Leap Motors International. We've announced partnerships where Dongfeng will be building certain products for out of China, Tatra in India, an MOU with Land Rover. So those are just the automotive-related partners. But if you go to technology, whether it's with the various connectivity software developers, it's all about partnerships going forward. And I think all manufacturers, in many cases, all the legacy manufacturers also realized that you can't do it on your own.
Well, I think, you know, Stellantis positions itself with, you know, a basket of different brands under one umbrella. I've just knocked the mic again. You know, I talk with my hands. This is what happens. So the basket of brands under the Stellantis brand, do you think that's helped or hindered you in this development of the business as you go forward?
Just as we were talking earlier, the South African market is – the price point for electric vehicles is below 400, and then we're seeing the growth coming out of what BYD is achieving, what some of the others. So you're going to see more and more product coming into that price category.
That was it's a fantastic segue into discussing what's actually going to be happening locally in specifically in regards to our EV development. So we have some EVs being sold in South Africa, but when you look at our comparative markets and other markets overseas, we are way behind in terms of our EV sales. And I think, I mean, to a certain extent, that's attributable to policy that's in place, government incentives that other countries have put in place that maybe we haven't put in place. But at the end of the day, it comes down to price. And when we've got, what did you say, about 64% of all our cars sold on the road is under 400,000 rand. Exactly. If you don't have an EV below 400,000 rand, you're not going to sell any. And you're not going to get to that critical point of where you get 5% new sales into EVs.
It's the acquisition price, but probably more importantly, total cost of ownership.
Yeah.
It's how much it's going to cost me, cents per kilometer, whatever it is. But the good part is we are seeing more and more product coming in below 400,000.
So what is Stellantis going to be bringing in below 400,000?
Watch the space. Or
are you not at liberty to discuss at the moment?
Certainly our e-platform, e-car, is obviously aiming to be very competitive in there. And then for us, a big part of the future, not only here, but particularly in Africa and other developing markets, is micro-mobility.
Ah, you mentioned that earlier, so I was going to pick up on that, but...
And I'm talking about micro-mobility.
Tell us about it.
Two-wheeler, three-wheeler, and small four-wheeler, electric again. And you only have to go to Nigeria or Kenya or any of the East or anywhere in East Africa, and you'll see the extent of micro-mobility. And it's particularly what's happening on EV micro-mobility, in that it's not about the actual device, the two-wheeler or the three-wheeler. It's all about the energy. So there's a whole new business that's developed where effectively they put their own batteries in, and it's swappable, it's rechargeable, they offer the charging station. So it's the fuel station of the future. And because if you really look at micro-mobility, it's all about giving people economic freedom, starting businesses. So the critical element is that you must be able to earn more dollars per day than it costs you.
A concept we need to get across to governments at some point in time. If we continue to beat this drum, maybe one day they will listen.
So from a Stellantis point of view, under the Fiat brand, we start with micro-mobility.
So that's going to happen under Fiat?
It's under the Fiat brand, and the first product that we'll bring to market in South Africa will be the Triss, which is a three-wheeler, electric, can carry half a ton.
Half a ton?
Yep. 500-kilogram payload.
I think micro-mobility will work in South Africa because, you know, the scooter culture that exists in Africa doesn't exist here, never has. Lots of people have tried. I think the probably the most successful scooter culture we have is Checkers 6060, you know, sort of driving that. And maybe it'll be an easier transition to swap that fleet into electric. Do you see that being a culture change that might be adopted in South Africa?
It's going to take time. But if we'd looked back and what's happened on last mile delivery, if you just as you were referring to on 6060 or any of it, it's phenomenal, the growth that's coming. So, yes, there's a place for it. We're also seeing people experimenting with what traditionally throughout Africa is known as Bora Bora or Bora Bora. It's the motorbike that carries two passengers or one passenger.
Okay.
So I think there's a lot of opportunity to grow, create small businesses for people to be able to earn money, earn a living. We have a project that we, with our distributor, Care and Care Group in Uganda running, which is taken single mothers and given them their license, given them access, and they're running businesses. They're delivering product, they're carrying people around, and they're actually earning enough to afford and support, in a way, their children. It's phenomenal what we're seeing and how it can unlock something for people.
And that's coming down to the fact that, A, it's affordable. You mentioned total cost of ownership, cheap to run.
Very important.
Gets you from A to B and is reliable. You know, so.
And I think that's where we come back to what I was saying on the Stellantis strategy, which is not just full electric. It offers the journey through, depending on what the circumstances allow in the country, what the person's the consumer's pocket allows. So you can go from mild hybrid all the way up to battery electric. And we leave that as freedom of choice, and we will cover the full sphere. We already are.
Like BYD announced, they're going to put up a couple of hundred chargers in the public space for people to use. Is that a part of your strategy, or are you going to just?
I think ultimately there are people who are doing a great job in rolling it out. I think last week there was another charging setup on the N1 to Durban.
N3, that was zero carbon charge.
And you're going to see more and more of that. And as I was referring to earlier, what we see in Kenya, this is a new business. It's the fuel station of the future that's coming. So, yes, we will obviously cooperate, work with, and certainly it's an option there. But I think the right solution is charging infrastructure that can support all. I think the important thing with an EV is to remove the fear. It's not something correct. That you say, go to a dealership, test drive. That's not what's all about trying to sell an EV. Drive it, live with it for a weekend, live with it for 2 days, because then you really appreciate what you get.
You're exactly right, and you're not the first one to say that from across this table. In fact, someone else said, you know, the EV experience is one where actually we can't do it via reviews and YouTube videos and printed articles. We have to get bums in seats, because the transition is that radical, that new, that people really don't understand it until they've actually experienced it.
And
bums in seats is what counts.
And we talk about range anxiety, but the average consumer in Gauteng doesn't do more than 80 kilometers a day, or even maximum 100 kilometers a day. So
the price per kilowatt hour of battery packs is continually dropping. We have China to thank for that, because they're just producing so much of it.
So I think as soon as people can remove the fear of whether it's range anxiety, or the fact that in 5 years' time, what am I going to get back for my car? Those are the things that we've all got to reassure the consumer. But certainly, without doubt, if you've lived with one,
You're not going back. Well, we've seen that borne out in research from overseas. 97% of BEV owners will buy another BEV. They won't go back to ICE engines. So I think the writing is pretty much on the wall there.
Very much what we are doing is we're making sure that over the next 2-3 years, we will offer the full, in South Africa, we already do it globally, but give customers and the consumers the choice. Do you want to be ICE? Do you want to be plug-in, mild,
full? What works for your lifestyle?
It'll be there. Yeah.
Fantastic. That sums it up. I think we are good. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you would like me to ask you?
You can ask me anything.
If there's something I haven't covered that maybe you did want to cover.
Yeah. No, I think what is important is what we were speaking about previously, and that is that the South African motor industry is a crucial part of the economy. It's 5+% of the GDP. We all need to work together to sustain it, particularly, but sustainability means that we also need to ensure that what we build here is product that consumers want. We spoke about 60-odd% of the market being below 400,000. So that's very important to build affordable cars.
Those are the cars we need to build.
And very importantly, we need, which is starting to pick up momentum.
Where to for Stellantis in South Africa? What are we going to look forward to in the next 18 months or so?
So I think certainly we continue to grow. We will focus on what we call the core models for us, which is the Citroen range, the Peugeot range, Jeep. Leap will become more and more significant. And we continue to move forward in finalizing an industrial strategy that we can hopefully make all work and be in a position in the not-too-distant future to share exactly what that will be.
Fantastic. Mike, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. We could do this for hours and hours and hours. There's so much to cover, but I think we've got a brief look into it. I'm particularly excited to see how the micromobility aspect plays out, because I don't think there's anyone else who's looking at that really
There are a lot of players globally who play in parts of the micromobility business, but certainly with Fiat brand, it's first real. Major global brand that's taking a global approach to it, and It's going to be a journey. It'll go faster in some markets, but I do believe there's a place for it in South Africa, very much so.
Can't wait to see it. Mike, thank you very much. It's been
a
pleasure.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Interesting. We'll see what happens. Two-wheelers. I mean, people have tried scooters, electric scooters in South Africa before. People have tried the three-wheelers electric in South Africa before. You know, there's take a lot of things that drive around and drive us mental. I don't know if anybody the size of Stellantis has tried it, so if anybody can do it, maybe they can. We'll see. We'll see how that pans out. But I think anything to get rid of those checkers 60-60 scooters and make their drivers have something a little bit more robust is a win. Is a win. Absolute win. So let's see where they take us with that one, Duncan. Let's see where they take
right.
us with that one.
So, William, you want you've had a rant in this podcast already, but you're going to do another one. We're going to talk about subscription models and the floor is
what
yours.
Stupid concept. Whoever came out with this needs to be taken out, put against the wall, and shot in the head. I mean, it's rubbish. So the subscription model, dear and valued viewers, is one in which you buy your car. You go and give BMW or someone else R1 million for your car, and you then subscribe in winter for heated seats that cost you €80 or whatever it is, and then you can have heated seats for the winter. They're in your car. You have to pay to have it turned on. Or if you're driving, I think it was, I don't know whether Alfa were that stupid, but maybe Alfa came up with something along those lines that you could have your Quadrifoglio Ferrari engine thing, and if you wanted an extra 50 kilowatts for track day, you'd get onto your app on your phone and you'd dial it in, and that'd unlock an extra 50 kilowatts on the motor for you for a few hours whilst you had a track day session. The concept of it just drives me insane, and there was some traction with it at some stage, and thank God that the motoring public has some modicum of sensibility around it, because this has been rejected outright, finished, good. Gone, done. So it would appear that a lot of OEMs are quietly just putting all that bad thinking into the can, which is where it belongs. I can hand on heart say, if you offer me a subscription thing on my car when I buy it from you, I will not be buying it from you. Absolutely.
I think the Chinese OEMs have helped us here as well, because when you buy a Chinese car now, it comes with sat nav, it comes with all the bells and whistles included. You look at the Chinese.
Absolutely, it's in the car.
Optional extras. Oh no, sir, there are no optional extras. It all comes with a car. So
it's all there for you
to
use.
The European guys, who are the guys who are the problem with the subscription thing, I'm looking at you, BMW, who started this whole thing. So good. Chinese competition is forcing their hand, and of course the backlash by the car buying public, and it's about time.
It stems, I think, from a certain extent that maybe the consultants have got involved into these companies, the OEMs, and said to them, listen, you're in deep trouble. You can no longer be viewed as a car company. You now need to be a mobility provider. And I know Mike has just said that that's what Stellantis is, so I will cut them some slack. But, you know, car makers don't want to just make cars anymore. They want to pioneer autonomy. They want AI. They want to be on top of robotics. And, you know, you've got the likes of Tesla who are doing exactly that. And you know, so autonomous driving is a big part of Tesla's future. But who's coming up quickly on that is interesting is it's actually Hyundai.
Oh, yeah.
So at CES 2026, Hyundai's Motional Autonomy Division, Motional Autonomy Division. It's like, oh, God. It's a self-driving car. Right. Says it plans to start robo-taxi services in Las Vegas by the end of 2026. So that's interesting. I mean, you know, so Hyundai have quietly just sort of said, oh, okay, we're announcing that we're going to do this by the end of the year, 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I'm not entirely sure how long Tesla's time frame for autonomous driving has been going, but it's been longer than 6 months. So, you know, it's whether Hyundai actually bring it out in 6 months' time or not, I don't know. But it's interesting how these transitions and things are playing out.
I was interested to see that a number of European markets now are allowing full self-driving on their roads. I think the Netherlands was the first to introduce it and the regulations around it. And I saw just recently that Lithuania has done the same now. So you've got a Tesla, it'll drive itself in the, on the streets of Lithuania. It's 100%. This isn't theoretical stuff anymore. It's starting to happen.
It's starting to happen. And you know, watch the space. You know, it's one of those things that on the show we need to be very, very careful, Duncan, of preempting what technology is actually going to do. I prefer reporting on what it's done because that way you don't look like an idiot. But you also don't look like you're particularly on top of things. It's a brave new world, and you know, kudos to them for taking the step, because it's an inevitable one. You got to start somewhere. You got to plant a flag in the ground and say, right, here we go. Let's see how this thing pans out, and to a certain extent, you've got to hedge your bets. You've got to get to a point where you can say, this is the risk, this is how it's been mitigated, and both are acceptable. Let's see how it pans out. Mm-hmm. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
You wanted to talk about donuts next.
Yes. So here we go. Speaking of planting flags in the ground and taking a leap of faith. So Donut, this is a company based, I believe, in Finland that has manufactured solid-state batteries. Not designed them, not theoretical. They've made them. And because people are saying that they don't believe them, they've created a website calling donutbelieve.com to prove their tech and show videos to everybody about how these batteries work. And in all honesty, the only thing that's sitting at the back of my mind is the fact that if they had this thing waxed and done, they would have been bought already. You know, BYD or Cattle or whoever it is would already have them and at scale. So whether that is something that's whatever the founders are holding back on, or why that hasn't happened yet, I don't know. But they're claiming 400 watt hours per kilogram. That is a lot. So it's enough, that in terms of energy density, that's a lot of energy in a very small amount of mass, and a duty cycle of 100,000. 100,000 duty cycles. That's next level. So
at what cost, though?
You could buy. Well, you've preempted the question, haven't you? they haven't said yet. But the theory is, I could buy a battery and hand it down to my grandson at 100,000 cycles. So the pricing, I think, is where things are not quite as clear, because it hasn't really been released. They've had a couple of demonstration models in EV bikes and that kind of thing, and they're busy, as I say, proving their technology via the I Do Not Believe website, which has a whole bunch of series and gives you a countdown for when the next video is arriving. And so what they've done
is like a hype factory to me.
Well, this is why everybody's it's a bit like, you know, sort of Jag Type 00, isn't it? It's the massive hype, and there's a product. Let's see what it actually delivers against. Okay. So, something to watch. If it works, we don't know. We'll find out. But BYD, for example, have already released a new battery, 70% charge in 5 minutes, from flat. 90%
megawatt charge.
9 minutes. That's on a megawatt charger. Mm-hmm. That's on a megawatt charger. But it will take a 1.5 megawatt charge. Can you imagine charging a battery at 1.5 megawatts, what that must take? The chemistry and physics behind it. I'm
it's remarkable.
Gobsmacked. Absolutely gobsmacked.
And the electrical grids that are going to have to be built to support this infrastructure. And the sort of investment must already be starting in China to support this technology.
I think it is, you know, and we're just going to have to wait and see, because, you know, it's I just said we mustn't make future predictions about technology, but this is technology that's here. When's it going to roll out to us? Well, we're going to have to wait and see, but the fact is, the matter is, it exists. And because it exists, and because EVs exist, and because we've got chargers, it's likely to come rolling out. We're likely to have it. So let's just see.
And it's about time there were major advances in battery technology, because it has been holding back consumer electronics, certainly. I mean, it's crazy. You basically still have to charge every day. But with technology like this, the promise is that with the sort of energy densities that you charge your phone once a month or once every 2 months.
I thought I was a jaded cynic here. Wow, Duncan. I mean, look at how far our phones have come. I mean, look what you can do on them. The battery life for me is like incidental, but I suppose you're right in terms of EVs. But you look at the battery pricing. I mean, it's dropped from $150 per kilowatt hour capacity in a battery to under 50 in short order, and it's still dropping. I mean, it's not dropping as fast now, but it's still dropping. So, I mean, battery pricing is certainly been moving in the right direction for consumers. It's great. But one of the things that our mate George Minnie from Autotrader was saying is that one thing that hasn't gone in the direction of consumers is, are we doing enough to simplify the EV conversation for the person behind the wheel? And I'm like, well, he obviously doesn't watch our show, because we do. You know, we do simplify things for you, our dear and valued viewer. This is our job.
Don't be a meanie, George.
But it's very good.
I'm here all day.
I think I'm blushing. But yeah, and it's kind of like what we're trying to do to the show on the show, and it's very interesting. The same discussion came up actually again with Mike, was that you've got an enormous amount of change to communicate to your customers, and it's not massive change, but because they don't understand the change, there's a fear to it. There's an ignorance that is holding EV back to a certain extent, but once you broach that barrier, then people become a lot more aware of it. So, George, I think we are doing a job of it. Whether the industry is doing enough, I don't know, but certainly, you know, in terms of being able to dissect the lived experience of an EV, is something that you get from word of mouth, you get from talking around a braai, you get from listening to excellent and outstanding podcasts like this one, that we discuss these things. We say, listen, we had an EV on test and it was rubbish because it said it had 20% battery left, it didn't. It let me down. You know, but that's never happened. EVs are better than that. But for example, you know, so it's real world consumer advice, and I think that that's something that is certainly happening, and happening to a far larger extent. But you know, if you look at the changes that car technology has had over the last 10 years, forget about EVs. You know, just the tech that's going into cars these days, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
Gadgets on wheels.
In our next episode, we talk to Tracker, and we talk about how data gathering is AI'd in the background and presented to consumers and presented to fleet owners and presented to people in a format that they can actually understand. Because the amount of data we can now gather from cars is just, you know, it's stratospheric. You know, you actually can't process it all. So you need to be able to filter out what's actually relevant. And that kind of information, if you think about when you bought your first car, Duncan, I don't know when that was, probably same time around me, you know, like a long time ago, was just science fiction, absolute science fiction. It just couldn't happen. So, you know, the world is moving very rapidly, and we've seen such big changes in cars that I think, you know, consumers these days, we'll just touch briefly on a car I had for test recently, Chang'an Uni S. You know, so whenever I'm on a test car, if someone shows an interest in the car, I drive them around the block in it. And I had some chap going along. He literally said to me, is this another Chinese SUV? I was like, yes, it is. He says, have never heard of Chang'an. I said, you will. State-owned Chinese company. It's big. And this particular car is a 1.5-liter turbo petrol. So we didn't do a review on it on this car because it doesn't fit our mandate. But it goes like hell. It is petrol. People understand it. But when you get into it, it's still like spaceship. They're sitting in the spaceship. They don't understand it. You know, you and I are so used to 3D cameras and hover views. You pop that on and people just haven't seen it before. And they're like, wow, this is incredible. The touchscreen, the information screen, the sheer size of the seats, the luxury in this car for 469,000 rand, because I had the top of the range one. I mean, it's unbelievable value. So people are already overwhelmed by the advancement of tech in cars to this level, that adding EV to it just boggles their brains. You know, it's just a step too far. So you've got to deal with all of this, plus EV, plus the fact that, you know, your ownership experience is changing. So it's really interesting in terms of I suppose that we're quite close to the industry, quite close to the thing. We know quite a bit, but the amount that we need to still convey to consumers and buyers of cars
We're fortunate that we get to drive a lot of these vehicles, but you know, we forget that you know, a lot of consumers, most consumers in South Africa, most drivers in South Africa own cars in the sub 300,000. They've been driving their car for the last 10 years. Where before, you know, if they're lucky, they've got, you know, Apple CarPlay or Android Auto on a little screen in front of them. But beyond that, most consumers haven't even seen this stuff. You're quite right.
No, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's quite a shock, you know, because you think back in the day, you kept your car for 5 years and you traded it up and off you went. You know, but you had your BMW 318 and then you went along and you bought your BMW 320 and it was one model revision and it kind of like had a couple of extra knobs and things. Mm. 5 years ago, your new car to your five-year-old car today, chalk and cheese. Mm. It's like, my word. Mm. For example, vented seats for me. The biggest thing since sliced bread. I loved it. The Jeep launched it on the Grand Cherokee. I was like, oh, they're never going to top this. So this is the pinnacle. You know, you've arrived when you've got vented seats. Just cools you down in summer. It makes perfect sense. This car's got it. Vented seats. It has electric seats that remember your position. So when you get out the car, it slides the seat back for you. Mm-hmm. And it's 469,000 rand. Amazing. That's the stuff that you get in like million rand plus cars.
Yeah.
So, you know, the advent of changing a car every 5 years, you better brace yourself if you don't sort of keep up with these things. When you get into your car in 5 years' time, your brain's going to
implode. These Chinese SUVs are actually very nice inside. It's just a pity they all look the same.
Yeah, well, one comment is that it does look a little bit the samey, but it's got 138 kilowatts just out of, and it goes like crazy. It's a 7-speed gearbox, but you know, it's a 1.5 liter turbo, so 138 kilowatts from a 1.5 turbo. You know, you're getting a lot of turbo to generate that kind of power. So there's a bit of turbo lag there. You know, you just need to live with it. But when it comes on, so it's getting back to learning how to drive the car again, which is actually quite fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Speaking of mad Chinese cars, shall we talk about mad Chinese cars for a little bit? Because the first one we've got is this Neo ES9. And why did I bring this particular car up? Well, because it's big, first of all.
Good grief.
Second of all, it's just nuts. I mean, the guy swears he's not AI'd, but I mean, you could see him at the back of this vehicle. It's huge. So they're going X7, they're going for the AGGLS, the big Merc, the big J, the big Range Rovers, etc. What got me on this thing was, much like I said, you know, vented seats is the pinnacle, the bee's knees, the wasp's nipples of luxury. This thing has got what they call zero gravity seats.
What is that?
With massage. I don't know what a zero gravity seat is. I'm dying to find out. But it's got massage, and the kicker, foot massage. Foot massage. I'm sorry. Why? You know, okay, so obviously that's only when you're being driven in the vehicle. I'm assuming they're not going to massage your foot when you got it on the accelerator or on the brake pedal. But foot massage. It's just, if that doesn't qualify,
it looks like drove down the road and swallowed a Mini and probably then swallowed another one.
Yeah. You are Mini. You will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. You know, it's just like, anyway, I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever going to bring Neo to South Africa, but I do hope they come, because I mean, it's just Look at it.
Bonkers.
It's just nuts. Absolutely bonkers. And then the second car we have to talk about is actually the timing couldn't be better. This is beautiful. From BYD, but it's the Fangcheng Bao FCB. So this is their premium range. And this, I'm afraid to say, is probably the car Ferrari should have built.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
1,000 horsepowers, 800 volt architecture, direct pressure on Porsche Taycan territory. No. Taycan is a four-seater thing. This is not Taycan territory at all. This is two-seater sports car, Ferrari, Lambo.
Mm-hmm.
You pick it. This is proper. And I have to say, it looks amazeballs. So we'll see if it comes out. It's at the Beijing Auto Show, which is over a month ago now. But I honestly think that's the car Ferrari should have bought.
I agree with you.
What BYD should do.
That looks proper.
Sell it to them. Just sell it to them. Swap the badging out. BYD take the other one. They just swap the cars completely. Put the badge on the Ferrari one and the Ferrari badge on the BYD one. Job done. Why I'm not in marketing, I don't know. I would kick ass if I was a marketer. So there you go. Solve the problem for all of you. Done.
Very nice. Very nice. I wonder what it's going to cost.
Well, the Ferrari is coming out at, what was it? Something like over 10 million rand?
600,000 euros.
600,000 euros.
Yes, exactly.
I'll go out on a limb here, Duncan, and I'm going to make a prediction.
It's cheaper.
The BYD will be cheaper.
I think you might just be right on that one.
I don't know. It's a limb. I'm gambling with my career here. But I think it will be cheaper.
I think you might just be right, William. I don't think I'm going to take that bet with you.
Okay, good. Let's see where we end up. And that leaves us with one last thing to do, hot or not.
Do you have the buttons lined up in front of you?
In the magic of the internet, I'm about to have the buttons lined up. So just a reminder for everyone, including ourselves, super cool, cool, okay, dread, well, not dread, just no. Meh. Pass. Kind of. Two cars today. Can you guess what the first one
just
is, Duncan?
Two. Luce. Yeah,
just two. Yes. And you even pronounced it right. Not good. The Luce. The Luce.
I'm not even the Ferrari Luce. I was calling it the Luce, actually, to my eternal shame.
Well, it is Luce. It's going to have to be. 600,000 euros and it looks like that. Oh, No. I don't know what you think.
I agree with you. If I could reach out over the internet and through the screen, I would press the same button.
Our meh thing actually matches your shirt color, so meh. Meh.
What are you saying about my
Ferrari, what are you thinking? Go away. Try harder. Be better. the second car is actually a bit of a tricky one. Because it's the Toyota BZ4X. And that's Toyota's it's their first electric car coming to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good. It's got 500 k's of range. It does 0 to 105 seconds. It's well appointed. It's got, it looks good. It looks good. Mm. But it's 1.1 million rand.
Which is too much.
1.1 million rands. And that's just too much. It's just, There's so much in that space at that price.
What was Toyota thinking? Because the price that they've launched this at, if you compare it to the Australian market, where if you even take the top end model in Australia, you're looking at a top end price and a straight Australian dollar to rand conversion of about 800,000 rand. So there's 300,000 rand on top of the Australian price. Now, I know our import duties are high, and we have the ad valorem duties on electric cars here, but that does not make up for that price difference. You'd think that Toyota, with its first EV in this market, would want to come in with a more aggressive price point, and they clearly decided not to do that, which is a strange decision in my view. And I think for that reason, we can't make this car a hot choice. I'm going to hit the same button again.
1.182. I mean, it's almost 1.2 million rand. And yeah, I mean, it's a case of they're going to sell a couple because it's Toyota. You know, it's going to be reliable. It's going to be, you know, all the good things. It's surprisingly quick for you know. So it's not conservative in its looks. So I think it's got that going for it. But I think it's the wrong car. I'd much rather have an Urban Cruiser electric or a Starlet electric, or start getting below the 500,000 rand market and get that going. You know, that's Toyota's. That's the segment they sell the most cars into. So I find myself strangely drawn to the orange button for a Toyota, and it's electric, and it's just too damned expensive, Toyota. It's too damned expensive.
It's too expensive. Overpriced.
I still want to drive one, but it's too expensive. And mind you, I said the same thing about the Alfa Junior, and I still love that car. But you know, it is what it is. But shall we?
We do.
That's a wrap for our episode 7, Duncan.
Prince William, always good to chat to you, and we'll be back with episode 8 next week. More electric,
a lot of fun
and nonsense talk. So we'll see you then.
Fabulous.
Thanks, William.
Bye bye, everyone.